tonight is Isaiah chapter 10, and I find in here such wealth of stuff that I particularly want to highlight tonight, and we'll end with that arch of information at the end of chapter 10 that goes all the way into chapter 12. It's a beautiful poetic style that I'll cover, and you'll understand as we get through
chapter
there.
10.
Chapter 10, verse 1 begins with hoi, in English, woe. Woe to those who enact evil statutes and to those who constantly record unjust decisions. The Hebrew is repetitive. Hachokakim chikikei aven. So there is an enacting or a statute making, a chok. You know what a chok is. It's a statute. And
ordinance.
So they're making an ordinance. They ordinant the ordinance. They sign the signature. They amplify. It's like in chapter 9, Ki yeled yulad lanu, a child will be childed to us. I love his poetry. He uses a verb as a noun as a verb, and he amplifies both by doing that. So here he says, there are those who are making statutes. They're statuting statutes. Mm-hmm. And to those who constantly record, it says in our version, unjust decisions, but the Hebrew is aven, meaning sinful. God's basically calling us to the courtroom. He says, you've been making statutes, I'm going to show you mine. You want to live by the sword, you're going to perish by the sword. You want to live by the law, you're going to perish by the law. And you want justice, why don't you give justice? Verse 2, so as to deprive the needy of justice. L'chatot midin dalim, to stretch out the needy of justice. You're going to rip it off of them. You're going to take it away from them. You're basically making justice work for you, not for the others. So what would we call that? Injustice. Mm-hmm. So you're calling it justice, but you're negotiating with the terminology itself. He said that earlier in chapter 5, wasn't it, about calling darkness light and light dark.
Yes.
And we basically rearrange our vocabulary to fit our own wishes. God help us. So he's really upset at them, and he's going to use the ones against whom they were fighting to come back against them. This is going to be terrible. To deprive the needy of justice and rob the poor of my people of their rights, of their mishpat, of their justice, so that widows may be their spoil and that they may plunder the orphans. What's spoil? Ill-gotten gains. Yeah, they don't profit. That's right. Yeah, so he's taking... What are you supposed to do with orphans? In this regard, look after them, pay for them. Instead, we're ripping them off. People whom we're supposed to attend, we're actually making them attend to us. And of course, the Hebrew is bazaz, and the spoil is shalal, like in Meher Shalal Hashbaz. Remember, the children were signs. Chapter 8, verse 18, I and my children are signs, he said, of who God is and what he's about. So tonight we're going to see his remnant, Sha'ar Yashuv. Remember, that was his first child. A remnant will return. And he uses that phrase, Meher Shalal, from spoil in verse 2, and bozaz, to plunder, as a constant theme, a repeating phrase that comes back to bother us. It's supposed to bother us. When you hear about your sin again and again and again, it's designed for what? Why does God tell you about your sin? Stop doing it. A warning to stop doing it. Exactly. Rather than, oh yeah, that's just who I am. I mean, how many people do you encounter who have a particular sin and they say, well, yeah, that's just who I am. No, that's what you are doing, but God wants you free from that. So you don't have to be like that anymore. So when he calls us on the carpet, when he tells us of our sins, it is for the sake of abandoning them rather than living in them. So when he says this idea of shalal, the spoil, widows may be their spoil. Goodness sakes, take care of the widow. Yeah. Don't spoil them. Don't rip off from them. Mm. It's saying to people who are into filthy lucre or stealing money, stop doing that. They say of religious people, especially religious leaders, that gold is one of the three nooses on which we hang ourselves. And I think about that a lot. You know, I buy my own banana bread. I buy my own coffee here. I come in. I put down my money, and when you're not here, I put down my... Oh, yeah, we all do that. We all pay our own way. And I think, I'm going to lose my soul for $1.50? I don't think so. Here, plop. You know, so if I can take care of a little thing, please God, I'll take care of that $100 note or the $5,000 note if somebody ever sends us one. You know, I'm not going to be, oh, that looked nice in my wallet. You know, that doesn't look nice. So if you're faithful in little, you'll be faithful in much. That's true. And that's why God says to us, take care of the widows, take care of the orphans. By the way, that's going to be a regular theme in Isaiah. Verse 3, what will you do in the day of punishment? Look out. There's coming a day. It's going to come back to bite you. And in the devastation, which will come from afar, Hebrew word for devastation, Shoah, catastrophe, devastation. Well, Holocaust was a word that meant burnt offering. And it was a Bible term used biblically in Leviticus for the whole burnt offering up until the late 40s. But after the late 1940s, nobody used that word anymore in the Bible because the Jewish people assigned that to themselves. It was an accomplishment. That is, our 6 million dying accomplished something. What? The birth of the state of Israel. So we saw that as, if you will, a noble sacrifice that caused something good to spring. However, lately, I'd say in the last 15 years, certainly the last 10, the word Shoah has replaced Holocaust because there's nothing good that came out of it. That's the way the moderns would say. It's a catastrophe. It is a devastation, as our term uses it, right. Our Bible uses it.
Sure.
That has no benefits. In other words, Israel happened okay, but still 6 million. That's a tragedy. It's not anything good. They don't make anything good out of it. Those people were evil. Our people should not have. So they made it much more binary. A devastation which will come from afar. To whom will you flee for help, and where will you leave your kavod? We translate it wealth. What are you going to do? Where are you going to hide? What's going to save you? Yeah. When you think about it, you could ask anybody in walking past our shop. You could ask anybody in your neighborhood, anybody at the water cooler at work. Hey, life's a mess, or this situation is bad. So whatever it is, and we say, what's going to fix it? We look at our potholes in the neighborhood, or we look at the queues to get into this venue or that. We say, it doesn't work right. Who can fix stuff? And those are all minimal compared to widows and orphans not getting their provision. So God basically is calling us to the courtroom and saying, do you have an attorney? Because you're going to need something. What are you going to do with all your money? What are you going to do? Who are you going to flee to? Verse 4, nothing remains but to crouch among the captives or fall among the slain. In spite of all this, his anger doesn't turn away and his hand is still stretched out. Again, that's the left hand of justice. Changes gears and he calls now Assyria. Remember, they're the bad guys. The ones that others had been making an alliance to thwart. And he says, woe to Assyria. Again, hoy, woe. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. Wait a minute. God's angry. What do you mean Assyria is the rod of his anger? This is a rod like, who uses a rod? Moses used a rod. Yeah. So it's a shepherd's guide. So God is going to discipline us with Assyria. That's the agent of his wrath. And then what does he say? In whose staff, there's that shepherd's crook, in whose hands is my indignation. God's anger, his hostility, his upset, his justice is now going to be meted out on Israel via the Assyrians.
Yep.
They're the bad guys. I send it against a Goy Chanef, a polluted nation. He doesn't call us Am, which is a traditional way to call us the people, but Goy. Nation, similar to all the other goyim of the world. Now, to be fair, the first use of goy and the second use of goy in the Bible are both applied to Israel, a great nation in Genesis 12, and goy kadosh, holy nation in Exodus 19. That's what God's called us as Israel to be. And yet, it took just a few hundred years and the word goy becomes a derisive word that means one of those guys. Now one of those guys is us guys. We have become a polluted nation. We're no better than anybody else. That's why justice comes. Not because God says, you know, you sinned last week, Jerry, and that's enough. I've had enough of Israel. You know, it's not one person. It's comprehensive. It's across the board. The whole nation has acted independent of God as if God doesn't exist in the same way the nations do. So he says, you're going to act like them. You're going to cop it and commission it against the people of my fury. So I send it, Assyria, against Israel, against a godless nation, and commission it against the people of my fury. What a phrase not to wish. Dear friend in Messiah, that's okay. Dear people of God's fury, no, you don't want that attributed to you. And the Hebrew word for commission is tzav, commanding. Commanding it, Assyria, against the people of Israel. So how can God be upset at Assyria if he commands them concerning Israel? If Assyria is the bad guys, and yet God commands them to take Israel down, well, then Assyria is just following God's will, being in God's plan. Doesn't that bother you? And so there are reactions to the announcement that we ought to have. Now, he's going to make another announcement in verse 12. We'll get to that in a moment. So here's this announcement, this commandment, this will of God, commissioned against the people of my fury to capture booty and to seize plunder. What are those two words? Shalal and Baz. Meher Shalal Hashbaz. See, you're going to hear it again. So now he sends Assyria to go capture booty from Israel and to seize plunder from Israel and to trample them down like mud in the, Ar says, in the streets. It's bachot, bachutz, it's, you know, chutzot, outside. This is not the kind of thing you want to read in a morning email that you overhear. You know, carbon copy Asher, God sending a note to the people of Jordan, please go take down Asher, carbon copy Asher. Asher reads, uh-oh, I'm now going down. There's nothing I can do about it. Or is there? See, that's what you want to hear. Or is there? Verse 7, yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather in its it is its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. For it says, are not my princes all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish, or Hamath like Arpad, or Samaria like Damascus? As my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images just as I've done to Samaria and her idols? This is the first response after God speaks first in verse 5 and 6, announcing Assyria's commission. The Assyrian, by the way, is not actually present, but you kind of hear his conversation. This is the Assyrian responding, the king of Assyria responding. And he's kind of indignant to be assigned. Who am I? What are you? What do I care about your thing? I'm going to go do what I want to do. So these are modeled speeches. They sound like other things from history. I'm not going to talk about that. But the literary function here, it fits naturally into like a psychological warfare of this particular battle. We're seeing Assyria preparing for negotiation, plucked out to illustrate Assyria's attitude and character, just like Babylon did in Genesis 11, and the Babylonian king of Isaiah 14, we'll see him soon. Tyre, Egypt, Edom in Obadiah. I mean, it's just a common biblical theme. They say, who is the Almighty? Who's God? What do I care what he thinks? I'm going to go do what I'm going to do. Verse 5, if I remember right. Yeah, there's no vowel, no verbs. No verbs. It's just calling. It's like the cast of characters at the beginning of a playbill. And then the prepositional phrases are up front in verse 6. Against a godless nation, I send it. It sounds like Yoda. Against the people of my fury, I'll commission it. It's another device of Isaiah. I have fallen in love with his style as I read it. I've never read it this well, I mean this way, and I'm impressed with his rhetoric. I think he must be a scholar. I think he must be a very smart man. So God's intention is clear in verses 5 and 6. But the word order again inverts in verse 7. Again, no verbs in 7 and 8. End of 7 and 8. These are short statements, no verbs, until verse 10 and 11. They're deliberately insulting, and they're denigrating They're likening the idolatrous nations to Samaria, which was what? Northern, so it's Israel. And Jerusalem, which is Judah, the south. Think Civil War Americans. The choice and balance of the vocabulary, the grammar, not to mention the sounds of the words, all work together to achieve the effect intended. This is one of the strongest literary pieces in Isaiah's comprehensive visions. So he calls all these places, let me see if I can tell you where they are. Hamath lies well to the south in Syria. It's an important independent city. To us today, it doesn't mean anything. Where's Hamath? We don't know. David collaborated with its king hundreds of years earlier. It was subdued by Assyria just about 4 years before Isaiah's writing, 738 BC. Remember, he's writing about 734. There was an uprising. Arpad is usually paired with Hamath. They're mentioned as cities destroyed by the famous Tiglath-Pileser III, located about 25 miles north of modern Aleppo in Syria. That's a place we can find. You don't want to be there. Syria's in horrible shape. Most of the people, by the way, the conversation on the news is all about Syrian refugees. Most of the refugees are still in Syria. They call them refugees. It covers a broad number of terms. The number one term it covers is displaced person. So if somebody leaves Sydney and goes to Tamworth, they're still in New South Wales. They're a displaced person. If they go to New Zealand, then they're a refugee, in our sense of the word, looking for asylum. But most of the Syrian refugees are under the rubric of the term displaced persons, not misplaced, displaced persons, and they're just running away from their home. They don't have anything normal. Those who remember the American situation when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, it was pretty devastating to the American South. I was in Houston, Texas, which is a few hundred kilometers west of New Orleans, just about 2 weeks subsequent. And I was speaking in Christian churches here and there all around Houston. There was not a church where I spoke, probably 13 or 14 churches, where there was not someone from Louisiana who had been displaced, who was now living in somebody else's home in this city. And if it happened in Houston, it was spread all over the American South as people just got in a car and drove faster, got in a bus and were sent somewhere. Well, that's the situation in Syria today. People are displaced, going here and there, and we're only seeing the noise about Hungary and Germany, etc., with the refugees in that more defined term. Still, it's a horrible situation, and Aleppo is not in a good place. Samaria, the city built by Omri to be the capital of Israel, it came under pressure from Tiglath-Pileser just a couple decades earlier under the reign of Menachem. And he, Tiglath-Pileser, actually invaded the land. So it is a turbulent place. When he talks about Samaria and plunder and spoil, you would think that they would get it because they'd been plundered. And Damascus was the capital of Aram, one of the oldest cities in the world. And Tiglath-Pileser actually conquered Damascus. So those are the cities, verse 9. Is not Kalno like Carchemish, and Hamath like Arpad, and Samaria like Damascus? These are all irrelevant. What do I care? As my hand has reached into the kingdoms of the idols whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, I'm going to do to Jerusalem just as I've done to Samaria and her idols. This is the braggadocious Assyrian. Okay, so then verse 12 kind of throws another spanner in the works. So it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he'll say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. Wait a minute. He punishes Israel by using other nations, and he punishes the other nations. Why? Because they are arrogant and because they're living sinfully as well. So they've been brought near to the possibility of encountering God, God's rule, God's kingdom, God's methods, God's laws. And they've rejected it, whether it was a prophet like an Isaiah or Hosea or Obadiah or somebody who explained, dear king, let me explain something. You're messing up and you can't touch God's people. It's not that Genesis 12, touch a Jew, you're in trouble, but it's because they live unjustly also. And they've been encountered by the Jewish people and therefore the laws of the Jewish people, which are the laws of God, and they've rejected those laws. So it's not that they touch Israel, although that's, I know I've heard that 100 times from preachers, but it's because they've rejected the God of the Jewish people, not the Jewish people of God. Because look what he says, verse 12, I'll punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. Again, the word haughtiness, raising up, lifting up. We've said that of Messiah. He's Ram Benisah, high and lifted up. It's the word Ram, room. You lift yourself up. What does Yeshua say? He that lifts himself up will be humbled, will be abased. And whoever humbles himself will be lifted up. There's that theme that Isaiah has regularly. The mountains will be brought low and the valleys will be raised up. Whether it's an Assyrian mountain or a Jewish mountain or an Israeli mountain, whatever it is, if you are proud, you will be flattened. So it doesn't say in verse 12, I'll punish the fruit of the anti-Semitic heart of the king of Assyria. See, it's not because he touched Israel. It's because he's arrogant. Hebrew word, Godel, Godol, strong, mighty. You've made yourself larger than you ought to be. Not a good idea. Verse 13, for he has said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom I did this, for I have understanding. I removed the boundary. I feel like I should be saying this in a haughty British accent. I apologize, all British people. I'm so sorry. I removed the boundary of the peoples and plundered their treasures. And like a mighty man, I brought down their inhabitants. And my hand reached to the riches of the peoples like a ken, like a nest. As one gathers abandoned eggs, I gathered all of the Eretz, all the earth, and there was not one that flapped its wing or opened its beak or even chirped. So he's saying, I have reason to conquer. I have reason to boast. I don't have an arrogant heart. I have a realistic heart because I am the greatest. So here's the problem. When you are winning, you still have to be humble.
Yes.
I don't know if you saw the rugby league final. Neither team boasted. That is exactly what you want to be when you're the king of Assyria and you win and you're great, you're gadol, but just don't be gadol levav. Don't be great in your heart. Be humble, because if you're not, be sure God will humble you. Right. One of my favorite phrases is, that's you true. Cannot humiliate a humble person. So you can't humiliate a person who's already humble. And God will humiliate us. That's what he's saying. Israel, you're living haughtily. You're not taking care of the widows and orphans. You're loving yourself. God will have the final say. And we have to allow him to make us humble, or let me recommend that we get there first. Verse 15, is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? What a reality of who you are, O Assyria. You're an axe in the hand of God. Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? That'd be like a club wielding those who lift it, or a rod lifting him who's not wood. It's nonsense. It ain't going to happen. Therefore, the Lord, the God of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors. A stout warrior is fat. So the wasting disease is wasting away. It's leanness. In other words, he's going to deplete you of your strength. And under his glory, a fire will be kindled like a burning flame, and the light of Israel will become a fire and his Holy One a flame. And it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in a single day. So God's going to turn, and the victim, Israel, is going to now become a flame and burn the very thorns and the briars and the weeds, if you will, of the garden that thinks itself beautiful. It's going to come back to bite you. Don't be proud. He'll destroy the glory of the forest. There's the word kavod. Earlier we used it as wealth of the forest and of his fruitful garden, both soul, nefesh, and basar, the flesh. It'll be as when a sick man wastes away. And the rest of the trees of the forest will be so small in number that a child could katav, could write them down. That word katav, remember, was what we saw earlier about unjust decisions, recording unjust decisions. Now, in that day, here's your answer. A remnant of Israel And those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them. In that day, the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return. What's that in Hebrew 21? Ar Yashuv, that was the name of his first son in chapter 7. So that's what he says. He's writing here and he says, my son's name. I'm writing a poem or I'm writing a prophecy and I write my son's name in it as a prophetic voice to the rest of Israel. I am so exuberant. I'm so elated. I'm so, my own son. This is the reality why I named him what I named him. A remnant will return. What's a remnant? Just a small portion of that which is the whole. The remnant of Jacob to the mighty God. Ki'im yiyamacha. For though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant within them will return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. For a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord God of hosts will execute in the midst of the whole land. So right in the middle, so everybody can see, an elect will be separated from the rest. The rest are going to be judged. A remnant will return. Return to what? To the purposes of God, to the plans of God. We're going to return. We, dear friends, are that representative. We are Sha'ar that's going to Yashuv, that's going to return. You look and think, why are there so few of us here? There are 50,000, say, 30,000 Jews, 40, 50,000 Jews in Sydney. Why are there so few of us gathered around these tables? Why isn't everybody here? Why aren't all the Jews here?
Exactly.
And it is for two reasons, probably. One, they haven't heard, and two, they have heard. And the pain is so many have heard and said, niet. What do? We return to God. Our responsibility, return to God, live God's way, do right. Therefore, thus says the Lord God of hosts, and this is the introduction to these arches that I have on the board over here. And for those of you listening online, we'll actually put this archway of, it's a rhetorical device. It's like a ziggurat, and we'll see that later on in chapter 52, or from the whole second half of Isaiah, chapter 40 to 66. It's a poetic device, if you will, a nice arch. So anger versus the Assyrians in verses 24 to 25 here is matched with drinking from the well of the water of salvation in chapter 12 and verse 3 to 6. They form, if you will, number one, and down at the bottom, one prime, kind of the reflection. Second, the Lord is going to lash out as Egypt in verse 25 to 27, and it's similar to chapter 12 and verse 2. Behold, God is my salvation, I will trust, I will sing in that day. Marching on Zion and Jerusalem, verse 29, is the same as, or it's parallel to drying up the sea of chapter 11, verse 15 to 16. Anyway, you'll see that. We'll look at that a little more clearly next week. I'll just give you that as a framework, and we'll look just at a couple verses. Verse 24, therefore, thus says the Lord God of hosts. I love that. That he is Yahweh Tzvaot, Adonai Tzvaot. O my people who dwell in Zion, don't fear the Assyrian who strikes you with the rod and lifts up his staff against you the way Egypt did, because in a little while, a very little while, ki od ma'at mizar, while my indignation against you will be spent, my anger will be directed to their destruction. So I'm on you. You're right. You're right. I'm after you. I'm trying to get your attention. I'm trying to smack you upside the head to change you. But it's a very little while. I'm going to turn it back on those boys. You're going to be okay. The Lord of hosts will arouse a scourge against him like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. And his staff, so there it is, the rod and staff, will be over the sea. He'll lift it up by the way he did in Egypt. So it will be Bayom Hahu, I think, in that day, that his burden will be removed from your shoulders, his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be broken because of Shemen, oil, really fatness. He's come against Ayath, he has passed through Migron. At Michmash he deposited his weapons or baggage. They've gone through the pass, saying, Geba will be our lodging place. Ramah is terrified, and Gibeah of Saul has fled away. Cry aloud with your voice, O daughter of Galim. Pay attention, Laisha and wretched Anathoth. Medmena has fled. The inhabitants of Gebim have sought refuge. Yet today he will halt at Nob. He shakes his fist at the mountain of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Behold, the Lord, the God of hosts, will lop off the boughs with a terrible crash. Those also who are tall, lifted up, Ram, in stature will be cut down, and those who are lofty, Gavoa, will be abased, Shafel. He will cut down the thickets of the forest with an iron axe, and Lebanon will fall. There is an assurance of problem, of suffering, that the smart aleck is going to get his, and the smarter aleck will get his also. Yeah. The Assyrians are going to get theirs. Don't be afraid of their rod and staff. Be afraid of the rod and staff of the God of Israel and turn towards him. So the call is constant here. Was the Shoah God's plan? If the Assyrians are God's plan to get Israel in these days, then the Shoah was God's plan to get Israel in those days. For God to be anything less is to be inconsistent. He's not inconsistent.
Exactly.
And why did God judge Germany? Because they mistreated Jews? No, because they mistreated Poles and because they mistreated homosexuals and gypsies. And the Lutherans who wouldn't stand up to them. And just all who stood up against them. No, they mistreated people, and that's why God dissipated the Third Reich. Yes, they mistreated Israel. Yes, as a result of that, Israel was born, and Israel is a reality today, now 7 decades subsequent. But it is that which was designed to get Israel, modern-day Israel, to turn and face God and say, mea culpa, or al-chet, or whatever we say, to say, God, I'm so sorry. What does the Holocaust show? What does any catastrophe show? The evil of man. The reality of the evil of man. The sin of man taken, going to full extent. How can I possibly believe in a God who would allow that? Well, because there is a God who allows people to use free will. And if you don't have free will, then you don't have a real God. And the end of free will can be wrong choosing as well as good choosing. So anyway, there's a lot to that. And I apologize for going a little long today. Sorry.